This is Christopher Mad Dog Russo's Digging Up the Past, an historical podcast taking a deep dive into the 10 greatest Major League Baseball teams to never win the World Series.
There's a long drive, way back in center field, way back, back, it is gone! Just brought this crowd to its feet with a catch, which must have been an optical illusion to a lot of people.
I even said to my wife, this is unbelievable that we're here seeing this. I went bananas because I thought it was a great catch. There ain't no doubt about that being a great catch.
Welcome, folks. Digging Up the Past. Christopher Russo, as we give you our third go-around of our podcast series, Thanksgiving football, Cowboys and Lions last November. Of course, the NCAA tournament the first 40 or so years in March. And now we do the baseball, the subject matter of this series, the 10 great teams that never won it. All right, now I'm not going back to the, 1914 A's. So 10 great teams that never won it. We chose 10. It was sort of a committee. The one caveat we put in, I did not put in a particular team, and then a year later they won it. For instance, the 69 Orioles had a great year. They were a great team, and they lost to the Mets. Well, I didn't put them in. We didn't put them in our group here because the Orioles won it the following year. The Reds had some great teams. Why didn't you put the Reds in there, say the 72 edition? Because they won a World Series in 75 and 76. So this is a group of teams that, for the most part, never got a chance to celebrate a title. There might be a player or so down the road who was on a team from this city that won, say, the 85 Royals, because we used the 77 Royals. But for the most part, it's a different kind of team. So I want to keep that in mind for you here as you go through this. Now, this episode, the focus is going to be really on the poster child of this whole podcast series, and that's the 54 Indians. In the last 60, 70 years, they are the team that everybody remembers. Wow, they didn't win it because they won 111 and 43. And remember, that's in a 154-game schedule. Now, they won in 48. All right, so that's only 6 years prior to that. They beat the Braves in 48. But there's not many players from that 48 team that are on the 54 team. There's a couple, Larry Doby and what have you, but not that many. So that is the reason why we allow the Indians to be in this segment 6 years after the team in 48 won. And for instance, in 48, you had Feller, and Feller didn't even pitch in a World Series in 54, so keep that in mind here, too. Now, Hank Greenberg was the general manager, the ex-great Tiger, you remember him, the great slugger, and they were managed by Al Lopez. Lopez was a catcher. He retired from Major League Baseball in 1947, and then he went on to manage the Indians' AAA farm team in Indianapolis, and he had good years there, and then he was hired to become the Indian manager in 1951. He was with the Indians for 6 years, and then he went on to Chicago and managed the White Sox, and that did a very good job there with the Go-Go Sox in the late 50s. He's really a hidden gem from a managerial standpoint. You don't realize how good a career he had as a skipper. The guy who helped us with that was longtime baseball broadcaster, Hall of Famer, and the great historian and a good buddy of the program's, Bob Costas.
Al Lopez is their manager, and he would then manage the 59 White Sox, who interrupted another Yankee run. The Yankees go to the World Series again, 55 through 58. The Go-Go White Sox, managed by Lopez, win the pennant in 59. Then the Yankees win five straight pennants again from 60 to 64. So between 1949 and 1965, only Al Lopez as a manager interrupted the Yankees' run of pennants.
Now, think about that for a second. The Yankees basically won every American League pennant from 49 to 64. Don't forget, they won five World Series in a row, 49 to 53. The only two times they did not win it, Lopez was the manager of the team that beat them. Think about that. I had forgotten that he managed the 59 White Sox, so I didn't realize that. So Costas, of course, gave us good information. Now, we had a nice conversation with Rocky Colavito. He's 87 years of age, born in the Bronx. Very good player. Hit 374 career home runs, made 9 All-Star teams, the whole 9 yards. Now, Rocky was not on the 54 team. He was in the minor leagues, but he got on the 55 team late in the year, and he was there in spring training. So he played for Lopez, and we asked Rocky how strong a manager Al was in game situations. Here's his response.
Excellent. No, I never played for anybody that was a better strategist.
Oh, really?
That's right. Al Lopez was a great manager. There's no getting away from it.
All right, so the Indians have a good manager. So we have established the fact that Lopez knows what he's doing. That's important. Greenberg put together a good team. So we have that organized, too, as the general manager. And we knew they had good players. You know, they had Al Rosen. They had Dobie. We'll get more to that a little bit later on. But what was the dominant aspect of this Indian team was their starting rotation. They had tremendous, tremendous starting pitching. And the whole league knew it. This is not a secret. They didn't come out of nowhere. Here is an Indians preview prior to this season on their pitching staff. Listen up.
Manager Al Lopez has his Indians really hustling in Tucson, Arizona, where the stage is set for spring training. And the Cleveland club looks to big things ahead. Al's pitching looks good as usual, headed by the big right-hander Mike Garcia, who won 18 games for the Tribe last year. Early Wynn, who hurled the Indians to 17 wins. And Bob Lemon, whose 21 victories topped them all. Bob Feller and Hal Newhouser discuss pitching problems, while over there at first base, Rocky Nelson and Bill Glynn are reaching for Luke Easter's job. Some reach, eh? There's plenty of snap in the Indians, says Al Lopez in Tucson.
The Indian pitching, folks, was so good that Bob Feller, who went 13-3 with a 3.09 ERA, who is one of the great right-handers in the history of the sport, Feller, he's their fifth starter. Think about it. And he did not pitch in a World Series. Their fifth starter. Bottom of the rotation. They finished the season with the best ERA in all of baseball. So they were, that's dominant starters. Now, they could also hit. They had a pretty good offensive team, and they had a good defensive team. Larry Doby played center field for him. Rosen, Al Rosen, was an excellent defensive third baseman. Obviously, Doby has been trained in the Hall of Fame for a variety of accomplishments. Rosen's career did not last long enough to reach Cooperstown. But in 54, he was as dominant a hitter as just about anybody in the league. Over a five-year stretch, Rosen averaged 31 homers, 114 RBIs, and hit .298. And he won the MVP award the year before in 53. But it just wasn't about Dobie and Rosen. Plenty of support. Bobby Avila hit .341 that year. Al Smith was on that team later on the White Sox. And, of course, big first baseman Vic Wirtz. They finished this season hitting more home runs than any team in the American League, and that includes the Yankees, which is significant. So this is a good defensive team and better offense than you think, with Dobie, Rosen, Smith, Wirtz, and Avila. No wonder they won 111 games. Now, believe it or not, they got off to a slow start. They were 13-10 after 23 games, and in mid-May, they were in third place in the American League, long before wild cards. And then they got hot. 11 in a row there in May, find themselves neck and neck with the Yankees for about a month. But then in the month of June, they had another winning streak of 9, which gave them a 4-game lead on the Yankees, and Cleveland never really looked back. The Yankees hung in most of the year. They won 103 games. So the Yankees had a good year, very good year. It's an excellent season. But they were a distant second throughout the whole year. The Indians just were that good. The lead was between 3 and 5 games. They had another 11-game winning streak in early September, so the Indians put the Yankees in a rearview mirror. They were just consistently strong, and with that pitching and everything else, from the start of mid-May after that 13-10 start all the way into the end of the year. They finished the year with 111 wins. Their winning percentage, by the way, of the Indians is .721. That's the best in American League history. That's not the most wins because it's 154 games, but it's the best winning percentage in American League history. And the Yankees, again, they won 103 games. I know it's fascinating about the Indians. They had so many good players. They did not have an MVP award winner that year. That went to Berra of the Yankees. Yogi won the award. He shouldn't have won it. But again, all the Indian players split the votes. They had 4 players in the top 6. Yogi finished with 230 points in the voting. Dobie was 2nd, Avila was 3rd, and Bob Lemon was 5th. So Yogi got a break. He shouldn't have won the award. He did. It should have been an Indian, but they had so many good players. Yogi was there to pick up the spoils. All right, now, no league championship series. The Indians go right into the World Series in those days. The league championship series didn't begin until 1969. So if you won the regular season title, you sat there and you got ready for a World Series, and the Indians met the Giants, led by the young and great Willie Mays, in that Fall Classic. Most baseball experts thought the Indians, if I was around, I would have said there's no way the Giants can deal with that pitching. Everybody thought they would make quick work of the Giants, but what unfolded in that October, believe me, nobody saw coming. There's plenty more ways to listen to Mad Dog Sports Radio than turning to Channel 82.
Miss any of the shows live? They are all available on the SiriusXM app.
Great video content from Morning Men, Adam Schein, and the doggy himself.
Have a laugh with Babchick from the basement.
Plus podcasts like Digging Up the Past and the Adam Schein Podcast.
And make sure to check out the Mad Dog interviews and highlights tabs for more great content.
It's all available on the SiriusXM app, free for most subscribers. So easy to use, even a dog can do it. All right, so Indians-Giants World Series. The Giants, the big underdog. They did not win 100 games. They won in the upper 90s. Very, very good team. Willie hit 341. An excellent team. Right, now, an advantage the Giants had, I would think, in 54, they were the underdog, was familiarity. They knew the Indians. In those days, there were only four teams that trained in Arizona, and the Giants and Indians were two of those four. Cubs and the Orioles were in Arizona that year, too. So you're talking about the Giants and the Indians. My gosh, they must have played a million times against each other in the month of March when barnstorming on the way back north. So a big advantage, you would think, for the Giants being familiar with the Indians. That's what Tom Verducci says. He's the great baseball writer and MLB Network and Fox baseball analyst. And we had a chance to talk to Tom about that very point.
I think that's a great point, Christopher, because we're so used to now, even with interleague play, there's such familiarity in World Series teams that we forget back in the day. And I think specifically with the Tigers seeing Bob Gibson for the first time in 68 World Series, teams had no idea what they were getting into by playing teams in the other league. There weren't a lot of games televised. Maybe a scout was watching them for the last 3 weeks of the season, but to see how teams played and the stuff pitchers brought to the mound, it was a surprise package for teams when you got to the World Series. But you make a good point. 54, there was some familiarity with the Giants over the Indians. So it wasn't like the traditional World Series where teams literally didn't know what they were getting into.
Remember, no interleague play in 1954. Not a lot of national exposure for these teams in this particular era. There's not a game of the week, per se. So it's not like there's not WGN. You don't see these teams very often. That's why the All-Star game was so much fun and so fascinating. It always gave the fans a chance to see the great players that they rarely saw, especially from the other league, which is important. Another advantage was the home field advantage. Prior to 2003, baseball alternated that home field. American League and the National League team, so records had nothing to do with it. Now, think about that for a second. If records did have to do with it, the Indians start the World Series at Municipal Stadium. The Giants won 97 games, so they were 14 games better than the Giants in the regular year. That's a big advantage. Not only do you get games in 6 and 7 in your ballpark, if it goes that far, you start in the comfort of your own home. The Indians didn't have that advantage, which is the problem. Also, the Polo Grounds, it's a bizarre ballpark, all right? Very bizarre. It played perfectly for Mays, but a bizarre ballpark. 483 to straightaway center, 450 to the power alleys, but down the line, very short. 279 down the left field line, 258, which will come into play down the right field line. These ballpark configurations are big factors as this series unfolded right from game one in the Polo Grounds on an October day in 54. And it was a total mismatch on paper. You would think there's no way the Giants have enough pitching. This Indian team beat out the Yankees for the first time in 5 years. They won 111 games. They got a great offense. They got great staff. Nobody thought the Indians, again, as we already mentioned, we're really going to be threatened by the Giants. And matter of fact, former Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig, he's another big historian of the game, and he's old enough to have seen these teams really front and center. Very familiar with that Giant team, and he was convinced that they had no chance of pulling off an upset.
I had seen the Giants all year because they were here playing the Milwaukee Braves. And they were, they were good. They had wonderful Willie Mays. They were good, but they were not a great team. You never would have believed that the Giants would have a chance against the mighty Indians with that pitching staff, with their hitting, Al Rosen having a phenomenal year. Oh, my goodness. There's no question.
All right, game one. Let's go right to this World Series against New York. Game one, it's Bob Lemon. He's a future Hall of Famer. He won 23 games that year. He's going up against Magley, Sal Magley, the barber. Remember, Magley was a Dodger for a good part of his career as well. Pitcher both franchises. Solid season. But, you know, the betting line would be, you know, minus 200 if in those days if you had it with the Indians because, you know, Lemon was Lemon. Top of the first, Indians get a couple of runners on base, and Wirtz brings him in. He's the big first baseman with a two-run triple. Right out of the gate, the World Series, basically, nobody's settled down yet at the Polo Grounds, and it's 2-0 Indians. Giants tie the game. They get a couple of runs in the third inning, so it's 2-2, and the score remains 2-2 as we get to the mid-innings and then into the late innings. So then we fast forward to the top of the eighth. 2-2, game one, World Series. Beautiful day at the Polo Grounds. Day game, of course. Larry Doby leads off with a walk, and Al Rosen follows that with a single. Runners are at first and second for Wirtz. Leo DeRocher not wanting this game to slip away. He pulls Magley, makes sense. Wirtz a left-hand hitter, and he brings in Don Little to face Vic. What happened next was only one of the greatest plays in the history of the sport.
There's a long drive, way back in center field, way back, back, it is caught. Hey, what he made, just brought this crowd to its feet with a catch, which must have been an optical illusion to a lot of people.
Funny, Willie always says he made a lot better catches. And he made the great throw. He twirled. He made that great throw back in the infield. So he had a great jump, over-the-shoulder catch. And again, he pivoted and spinned and got that ball back in the infield. So only Doby got the third base. Rosen stays at first. So if the game is in Cleveland, it's a three-run home run. Think about that. That's the importance of that home field advantage. And if there is a mere mortal in center field, just a mortal, it's 4-2. And Wirtz has his second two-run triple of the game. But this is Willie Mays we're talking about. This is not some mere mortal. This is the great Willie. So the score remains. You know who was in the stands that day? It was the aforementioned Calavito. Rocky was with his wife and couldn't believe his eyes.
Yeah, I even said to my wife, this is unbelievable that we're here seeing this. I said, I went bananas because I thought it was a great catch. There ain't no doubt about that being a great catch. But I've seen him make catches similar or maybe a slight bit better. Willie Mays is the greatest player I ever played against, okay? All-around player. Willie Mays could run. He had a great arm. He could field, I mean, with anybody. And he caught up to balls you never thought that anybody would catch up to. And he could hit with power to all fields. So, again, I repeat, he was the greatest player that I ever played against, Mickey being a very close second.
Again, from a World Series perspective, this catch, you know, stands alone. But again, you heard from Rocky that Mays did these types of things regularly. And if you talk to Willie, he wouldn't disagree. Here's a comment Willie made to longtime sports reporter Brad Palmer back in 83 about this iconic catch.
That wasn't my best, but that was the one that was in the World Series, and everybody talked about it. So who am I to argue with people? When they like a catch, they like a catch. In my mind, I didn't think I was going to miss the ball. In my mind, I always felt that I could catch a ball regardless of where it went. The only thing I was very proud of, only one guy advanced.
All right, now, despite Mays' great catch, it's still first and third. They are not out of the jam yet. Dale Mitchell would walk. Mitchell, of course, is the Dodger who struck out at the end of Don Larson's perfect game. That's the same Dale Mitchell. So the Indians have the bases loaded with one out. A sac fly here. They're in pretty good shape. But Mark Grissom deserves plenty of credit. He comes in. He strikes out Dave Pope. He gets Jim Hegan to fly out. Indians do not score in that eighth inning. Think about it. They had all sorts of base runners. They had a ball, you know, out to the yonder in center field and had nothing to show for it in a tight game in game one of a World Series. Lemon, he's pitching well. This is a guy who, you know, he's a Hall of Famer. Next couple of innings, Giants don't do anything against him. So we go to the top of the 10th. Extra innings, game one, World Series. Lemon's still out there. Cleveland has runners at first and third. They threaten again with one out in this top of the 10th. Bill Glenn strikes out. And that brings up Lemon to the plate. Now, today, there's no way Bob Lemon gets in the bat here. First and third, 10th inning, 2-2 World Series. He'd be long gone. But in a move that, you know, you got to remember the times And you know, the starting pitcher was the king in those days. You would never see it today, but Lemon gets in at bat, despite the fact that go-ahead runs in third base. So Lemon gets up there. Lopez keeps him in the game, and he lines out. He hit the ball pretty hard, but he lined out to first to end the inning. So we go to the bottom of the 10th. We're still tied at two. And Lemon, we don't have the pitch count, but he's still in the ball game in the bottom half of that 10th frame. First batter is out. Mays draws a walk, steals a bag. Lemon intentionally walks Hank Thompson to put runners at first and second for Monty Irvin. But DeRocher pulls Irvin back to the dugout and brings up his clutch pinch hitter, Dusty Rhodes.
Dusty Rhodes, sub outfielder, comes off the bench to bat for Irvin. He's been a big man for the Giants this season. 15 pinch hits in 45 trips. Rhodes cuts at the first pitch. And there goes the ball down the right field line. A home run into the seats, and the ball game's over. The Giants win this opener of the 1954 World Series 5-2. And the Polo Grounds rocks with tumultuous applause. The storybook finish is the biggest moment in the baseball career of Dusty Rhodes.
Back to Rocky Colavito. Remember, he's in the ballpark. He shares his firsthand account of the game winner.
You know, that ball, I mean, that was like the start of the Indians' bad luck. It was a high fly ball down the right field line, and even Davey Pope, he was a right fielder at the time, and he even jumped up to try to catch it, but it just got in the stand. I mean, everything went the Giants' way during that series.
Ball doesn't even travel 260 feet, but it left the park down that short right field line there at the Polo Grounds, and as Bob Costa says, the two key plays only happened because of the dimension of the stadium.
And that's a Polo Grounds home run. There's never been a more oddly configured baseball field than the Polo Grounds. Barely over 250 right down the right field line, something close to 475 to center field where Willie went to gather in the shot by Wirtz. Bullpen on the field in left center on the warning track because it was so far from home plate. So it played into it. The Giants winning that first game and the first two at the Polo Grounds, now they're filled with confidence heading to Cleveland.
All right, the Giants gained a lot of momentum with that game one win in the Polo Grounds, cannot be understated. And according to Verducci, that victory, very similar to another historic World Series moment several decades later.
Really, you have to think about game one, Christopher, as something that, you know, almost like, you know, the Dodgers beating, with the Gibson home run beating the A's in game one of the World Series, kind of setting the tone for the whole World Series with the Willie Mays catch, the Dusty Rhodes walk-off homer. Not to say they couldn't come back and win, but they didn't. I think things really changed with that win in the Polo Grounds in game one for the Giants.
In 1988, after Gibson hit the home run against Oakland, I was looking for a singular blast in past World Series that turned the momentum and gave the underdog a big leg up, you know, like the Dodgers against the A's in 88. And I thought of Dusty Rhodes in 54. Tracked him down for a morning sports report, and believe it or not, you know what Dusty was doing? He was a tugboat operator in New York Harbor, the Great Roads. Game two, similar story. The Indians lose that first game. It's a shot to the jaw, but they got off the deck right out of the gate. Al Smith leads off the game with a home run off Johnny Antonelli. Antonelli was a very good pitcher, and he doesn't give up another run the rest of the way. He gives up the home run to Smith, and that's it. And game one hero Dusty Rhodes comes through again. As I mentioned, he was a big factor here. He pinch hit this time in the fifth inning. He delivered an RBI single, remains in the game to continue to damage that Indian pitching staff, hits another home run in the seventh inning, and Giants win the game 3-1. So Rhodes basically has three at-bats, a two homers and a single in the first two games of the World Series. You getting the idea here that it just seemed to be a Giant World Series triumph? All right, now we go to Cleveland for game three. The Giants, all the momentum in the world, 80,000 file into Old Municipal Stadium. Early lead again, no issues whatsoever. They cruise to a 6-2 victory. They followed that up with a devastating 7-0 lead to start game four. 7-0 to start game four. Indians try to battle back. Johnny Antonelli comes in and he gets the last five outs for New York and delivers the Giants their first championship in over 20 years.
Lopez sends up another pinch hitter, Dale Mitchell. And he fouls to Thompson to give the Giants the game 7-4 and the series by a stunning 4-game sweep. In the clubhouse, bedlam breaks loose as television crews, photographers, and newspapermen endeavor to record the scene. The overall spirit, aggressiveness, and resourcefulness of the team, plus the superb leadership of Leo Durocher, brought the world championship to the New York Giants.
Now, we talked about that home field advantage. I think that was very important, the dimensions of the ballpark for the Giants. Good fortune for them. But to Colavito, this series really came down to one thing.
They didn't pitch as well as they were capable of, let's face it. The Indians had a great staff. There's no doubt about that. They were impressive, but, you know, every team has a setback or a downside, and they picked a bad time to have a downside as far as winning games and pitching as well as they were capable of. I mean, that staff, I'd take that staff any day of the week, any time of the year, in any era.
After the Indians of the 1950s faded, franchise did not have any success for the next 30 or so years. But since 95, believe it or not, the Indians ball club has had their chances. 12 playoff appearances, 3 World Series shots, but every time they came up a bit short. 97 against the Marlins, who can forget? They had a 2-1 lead in Game 7, bottom of the ninth, didn't get it done. 2016 against the Cubs World Series, 3-1 series lead, Game 6 and 7 at home, again, could not get it done. Bad luck, call it that. Call it a curse, call it that. But nearly 70 years after Mays' catch against Wirtz, the Indians are still looking for their next championship. For more episodes and baseball's greatest teams to never win a championship or to listen to previous seasons covering the history of Thanksgiving football and the NCAA tournament, download the SXM app, free for most subscribers. Download it today and search Digging Up the Past or subscribe to our feed wherever you get your podcasts.
Digging Up the Past is part of the SiriusXM Podcast Network. The executive producer is Bill Zimmerman. The associate producers are Chris Tyler and Andrew Emmer. Sound design is by Matt Damro and Joey DeFazio. Andy King is the director of sports podcasting for SiriusXM. Special thanks to SiriusXM's senior vice president of sports programming and podcasting, Steve Cohen, vice president of sports programming, Eric Spitz, and Mad Dog Sports Radio program director, Steve Torrey.